I'm Shoshana Bryan. I'm the Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center, and it's my privilege to introduce Ilan Berman, our speaker. Ilan is the Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington. An expert on regional security in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Russian Federation, he has consulted for the CIA, DOD, and a number of national security agencies and congressional offices. He's been called by CNN one of America's leading experts on the Middle East and Iran. He is a member of the Associated Faculty at Missouri State University and the editor of the Journal of International Affairs. He has written in just about every newspaper that you can name, so I won't name them all. And he is the author of four books: Tehran Rising, Iran's Challenge to the United States; Winning the Long War, Retaking the Offensive Against Radical Islam; Implosion, The End of Russia and What It Means for America; and most recently, Iran's Deadly Ambition, The Islamic Republic's Quest for Global Power. I will turn the microphone over to Ilan. Ilan?
Yeah. Yep. Thanks. Thank you, Shoshana. So anyway, thanks everyone for hanging on the call. It's a nice way to spend a lunch hour. So I'll try to make it as informative as possible. I'm not sure I can make it entertaining, but it's informative anyway. What I thought I would do is I would spend a few minutes talking about how Russia sees the Middle East and sort of what it's trying to achieve, and then end up at a conversation about what is possible to do with Russia. This is the main focus of a great number of people who are with the administration now, in terms of probing and testing what actually is possible. Is it possible to have a more pacific, less conflictual relationship between the White House and the Kremlin? So I think a good place to start when we think about Russian strategy and sort of how Russia envisions the Middle East is to understand that the Middle East is not indispensable to Russia. The Middle East is an area of interest, but what Russia really cares about is what it considers its geopolitical backyard, the countries of the former Soviet Union, countries and territories that in the conception of people like Vladimir Putin were stripped from Moscow by an accident of history, by political incompetence on the part of people like Mikhail Gorbachev. And these are territories that, as a first order of magnitude, Russia is trying to reclaim. Vladimir Putin, a dozen years ago, gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference in which he called the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. I have my own views about what that might actually be. I don't happen to think that the end of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, but that's how Putin sees Russia's decline from great power status. And so it's really instructive, because over the last 10 years or so, Vladimir Putin has made the recreation of a neo-Soviet sphere one of the key tenets of his foreign policy. And you see this in a number of ways. Politically, he's attempted to tether countries, sort of the weaker, more dependent countries of Central Asia, the Caucasus, and Eastern Europe, to the Kremlin, in fact, going so far as to go to war with them if they choose a different Atlantic path, like Ukraine did in 2013-2014. Militarily, he's tried to tether these countries together into blocks like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that Russia and in some cases China presides over. And economically, he's tried to bind these countries together with limited success into constructs like the Eurasian Economic Union, right? This is all to create what a friend of mine has, I think, very aptly called an empire of dependency. This is a sort of a neo-Soviet sphere. This isn't Russian or Soviet tanks coming across the transom, but it is an attempt to diminish the sovereignty of these states and to bind them ever more closely to Moscow. And this is, I think, charitably, this is the primary focus of Russian foreign policy. And this is where the Kremlin spends a lot of its foreign policy capital. But increasingly, it is beginning to look further and further afield. The appetite, as the Russians say, comes with the eating. And so in a very complicated but also very opportunistic fashion, the Russians are beginning to think about the greater Middle East as an arena where they can also flex their geopolitical muscles. And if you look at what Russia's done over the last several years, you can really sort of lump their objectives into three things. You know, the first is global ambition. The Russians see themselves historically and doctrinally as a great power. And the sine qua non of being a great power is being able to project power globally. So the Russians have devoted a lot of time to building up over the last couple of years, to building up their military capabilities beyond their immediate periphery. Something we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, one of Russia's primary objectives in its intervention in Syria starting in September 2015 was actually to solidify its maritime presence in the port city of Tartus, because at that time, that was the only point from which Russia could project military power into the Eastern Mediterranean. And if you're a great power, you have to project power globally. So the prospect of losing Tartus, if there is regime change in Syria, was really unpalatable to the Kremlin. But it's useful to point out that these ambitions are also ideological. It's not just sort of imperial impulse or imperial hangover. There is a very heady strain of ideology, all right, which is in the shorthand we call Eurasianism, in Russian political thought, that talks about Russia's ultimate destiny as an empire and how Russia has to build alliances with countries like Iran, for example, in order to achieve that goal. And the corollary of that ideology, which is very interesting for how we think about Russia and whether we can cooperate with them, is that Russia is destined to be an empire, but it's also destined to be in conflict with other empires or other sort of significant powers, most chiefly the United States. So the second sort of driver of how Russia sees the Middle East is opportunism. The two terms of the Obama administration saw the retraction of American interest in the Middle East, right, put charitably. And Russia has sort of seized the opportunity, right? Russia has sought to exploit the empty space that was created by a diminution of American involvement in the Middle East to make up all sorts of tactical gains. And you see this in the way Russia has attempted to step in and become the main arms supplier for countries like Egypt. Russia is simply trying to fill the vacuum that's left, that has been left over the last 8 years by American indifference. And the third driver, and it animates a great deal of the alliances that the Russians have actually tried to build in the Middle East, is good old-fashioned anti-Americanism. I know it's very much in vogue these days to talk about the possibility of having a more normalized relationship with the Russians. And I think to a certain point, that's actually possible. But remember, it's also useful to remember that there are limits to this normalization. The strategic goal of the Kremlin was and remains to expand its own power and to limit ours. And this is sort of true on a global scale, but it's also particularly true in the Middle East, where the Russians see that there's opportunity for them to play. And I'm a firm believer in the idea that personnel is policy. And so we sort of watching very closely sort of the shuffling of the deck chairs here at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But it's equally true when it comes to Russian personnel as well. The premise, the orienting premise of the Obama administration was that it was possible to reset relations with the Russians simply by dint of our sort of good faith efforts. I think to a certain degree, that's also true of certain people within the Trump administration who believe that by giving the Russians certain things, we can get them to cooperate. But it's useful to remember that there has been no corresponding reset on the Russian side, right? The personnel that run Russian foreign policy with sort of almost zero deviation are sort of older. They are cold warriors. They are Soviet or neo-Soviet ideologues in a way that makes it hard to imagine that the Kremlin and the White House would really have a non-conflictual relationship for any length of time. Even if a tactical normalization is possible, the long-term trajectory, I'm convinced, is more competition than cooperation, no matter what happens. this gets us, I think, to a discussion of sort of the two main areas where Russia is involved in the Middle East, right? One is Syria and the other is Iran. So let me sort of just take a couple minutes on each and try to lay out sort of what the Russians are trying to achieve. So the first in Syria, the first objective is sort of what I mentioned before, is the solidification of a strategic presence in the Middle East in a way that sort of rebounds to the net benefit of Russia's global power projection capability. So what you've seen since September of 2015 has been not only the solidification of Russia's hold on the naval base of Tartus in the southwest of Syria, but also, for example, the construction of a parallel air base on the northwest of Syria, right, flanking with the naval base on the bottom and the air base at the top, flanking the what could be called Alawistan, right, the enclave, the territorial enclave of where the Alawites that make up the rump support for the Assad regime, where they have their enclave. And not only that, but in the service of providing secondary support to Russian troops operating in the Syrian theater, Russia has facilitated and also maintained an open-ended expanded naval presence in the Eastern Mediterranean, right, through the deployment of vessels like the Admiral Kuznetsov. They have really built up their ability not only to project power into Syria, but also to project power into other places in the Middle East as needed as well. The second goal is political, right? All politics are local. And when, I think it's less the case now, but certainly at the time that Russia made the strategic decision to intervene in Syria, the Kremlin was under pressure to change the political conversation. This was a political moment where the campaign that the Russians were waging against Ukraine had sort of bogged down. The Ukrainians were offering stiffer resistance than the Russians had imagined. And as a result, the Russians were eager to change the conversation. Vladimir Putin was, in other words, trying to project the power that he was winning. And it was increasingly hard to do so in the Eastern European front. And so he began to look at the Middle East as an arena where he could play. And the third trend, and I would argue this is arguably the most dispositive, is Russia's own internal demographics. The shorthand version of this story is that Russia's Muslims make up the fastest growing minority within the Russian Federation. There are projections that say that by the end of this decade, one in five Russians may be Muslim. But it's also, which is sort of by itself is a benign development, right? All countries change in terms of demographics. But in the last decade, the ultra-nationalist identity that Vladimir Putin has erected has systematically shut Russia's Muslims out of key governmental positions, has sort of created an economic glass ceiling, has deprived majority Muslim provinces in the North Caucasus of prosperity in a way that has expanded the appeal of alternative ideologies, with Islamism being the chief one. And so in 2015, you saw the main Islamist group, Islamist terrorist group that's active in the Russian Federation, which is known as the Kafkazi Emirat, pledge bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Not holistically, right? There are still stragglers in the group. There are still elements of the Caucasus Emirate that still hold a candle for the bin Laden network. But nonetheless, increasingly, the Islamist scene in Russia is becoming more and more sort of ISIS-centric. And it's also mobilizing. Vladimir Putin gave a very important speech about 6 weeks ago in which he talked about the fact that by the estimates of the Russian intelligence service, the GRU, there were 4,000 Russians and 5,000 Central Asians that had, up until that point, joined the ranks of the Islamic State in the fighting in Syria and Iraq. The back of the envelope estimates are that ISIS has drawn, since its rise to prominence in 2014, a little over 30,000 foreign fighters from all over the world, right? So what those numbers tell you is that Russia is looking down the barrel at a legion of jihadists that have left their shores or left the shores of adjacent countries that total about a third of the entire caliphate in terms of foreign fighters. That's an enormous number, and it's a testament to sort of the significance of the Russian presence or the post-Soviet presence in Iraq and Syria, that Russian analysts now estimate that Russian is the third most popular language in the caliphate. That tells you something. And it also tends to animate Russian thinking about Syria, because in this context, what Russia is continuing to do in Syria in empowering Assad and providing him with the materiel and the personnel to continue to take the fight to his adversaries is simply a defensive move from the Russian perspective. Russia would much rather go to Syria to kill the jihadists there than wait for them to come home. And parenthetically, I would argue that earlier this week, there was a terrorist attack in the subway system in St. Petersburg, where there are at least preliminary signs that the terrorist who had carried out the attack was linked to these sort of to this dynamic. And it could very well be more than a one-off event. It could very well be the start of a cascading effect where Russia becomes increasingly unable to grapple with both homegrown Islamism and also the impact of returnees from the Islamic State. So on to Iran. And this is, I think, a really interesting conversation to have, because the Trump administration is actively having a debate about whether or not it's possible to flip Iran, flip Russia on Iran, whether it's possible to have the Russians become more compliant about squeezing Iran, about ensuring strict Iranian compliance with the terms of the JCPOA. Color me skeptical for a number of reasons. First of all, because of those imperial ambitions that I mentioned earlier, Iran plays a big role in those. In fact, the main ideologue of Eurasianism, Alexander Dugin, has written repeatedly that as Russia regains its footing on the world stage, it needs reliable allies, including Iran, to partner with in order to project its influence into the Middle East. In other words, Russia, as it begins to think imperially about the Middle East, increasingly sees Iran as a force multiplier rather than a hindrance. The second reason is cold hard cash. The Russian economy is slightly better than it was 2 years ago when the impact of sanctions that were levied on Russia as a result of its intervention in Ukraine by the United States and by Europe had really begun to bite. But Russia is a long way from being economically stable. In fact, the Russian federal expenditures as a percentage of GDP are actually rising. The back of the envelope calculation is that the annexation of Crimea, which took place in 2014, added something like a $7.5 to $8 billion line item to the Russian federal budget, because Russia is now committed to raising Crimean pension rates, for example, to the level of the rest of the Russian Federation. Russia is now committed to doing infrastructure projects in Crimea, right? This is enormously contentious on the Russian domestic scene, but it also creates a pretty significant liability, because the Russian government is spending more and more money at a time when it doesn't have a lot of money to spend. And in that context, the billions upon billions of dollars, right? The current tally is somewhere north of $12 billion in defense contracts that the Russians have hammered out over the last 4 or 5 months with the Iranians become very, very important. And I think it's probably a little bit naive to think that the Russians, when they are in an economic downswing, are able to simply dispense with Iran when Iran provides such significant infusions of cash to their federal budget. And sort of the third trend, and it ties into that sort of that long-term presence in the Middle East that we talked about before, is that ultimately, Iran cares more about Syria than Russia does. The Iranians have articulated the fact that their engagement in Syria is open-ended, that they see the stability of the Assad regime as sort of core and central to the stability of the Islamic Republic itself. And I think it's reasonable to conclude from those statements that the Iranians have no plans to exit Syria anytime soon. The Russians, on the other hand, are of two minds about this, right? You've seen a reconfiguration in recent months of the Russian military presence. Vladimir Putin is very leery of the possibility of mission creep there. And so what this gets you to is the idea that Iran has more of a stake in Syria over the long term than Russia does. But Russia does have a significant stake. It has a military stake. It has a political stake. And as a result, you will shortly, I think, get to a situation where Russia has to rely on Iran to ensure its continued access in Syria, right? Iran becomes the ultimate kingmaker in Syria. And what Russia does, the freedom of action that it has to do things there, to maintain its military outposts there, are going to be at Iran's sufferance. And as a result, Iran becomes a very important stakeholder in sort of Russia's conception. And getting crosswise with Tehran is probably not something that Kremlin policymakers want to do. And this leads us to, I think, sort of where we want to end up, which is what is actually possible to do with Russia? What are the limits of potential cooperation? I am not one of those people who think that it's impossible to conceive of any sort of cooperation with the Russians. I think you could very easily articulate a tactical menu of options on everything from counterterrorism, right, the joint fight against the Islamic State, to Russian assistance in U.S. space launch capabilities, and a whole host of other things, in which there is a potential for us to cooperate to a greater extent than we're cooperating now. However, to me, the measure of effectiveness of that cooperation, of any sort of overtures that the Trump administration makes to Russia, is going to be how much we can get Russia to do above and beyond what they're willing to do already by themselves. Because let's be frank, Russia sees the Islamic State as a threat, and Russia is planning to campaign against the Islamic State in Syria and elsewhere by itself, even without an American presence. So to me, it's not enough to talk about the fact that we can have a joint war on terror. To me, it's important to identify what the Russians are willing to do as a sign of goodwill that they wouldn't be doing on their own anyway. And I think that's a pretty good metric for all of us to use when we think about whether or not the sort of engagement that we're likely to see coming out of the White House towards the Kremlin is actually effective over the long term. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you. We'll give people a minute to assimilate that. We have some questions that came into us, okay, most of which you've answered, but let me go over the ones you have not answered. Can you estimate how many Russians have been killed fighting in Syria and what kind of impact that has on the Russian government's plans?
So it's a good question. The numbers are very soft, I think. There aren't any authoritative Russian governmental tallies that have come out of the Kremlin, of sort of any constituent organs that have talked with any degree of specificity about how many have been killed. In terms of proportional representation, Russians and members of the Kafkasian Emirat, members of the Caucasus Emirate, are actually very significantly represented within the Islamic State. So that number is not insignificant. However, getting a good beat on what that number actually is, I think, very difficult. I wouldn't be able to tell with any degree of specificity. The one thing I would point out, though, is that the size of the Russian Legion, if you could call it that, in the Islamic State is so large now that it's beginning to filter out into other conflicts. For example, if you do a close reading of who the constituent parties are on both sides of the Ukraine crisis right now, what you'll find is that there are Chechen loyalists, Chechens loyal to the Russian government, in the service of Ramzan Kadyrov, who's the governor of the Republic of Chechnya, who are fighting on the Russian side, right, on the side of the pro-Russian separatists. But there's also a Chechen legion fighting on the other side, a Chechen battalion that is made up of Russian Islamists that are alumni of the Islamic State and have headed back east and are now engaged in fighting Russia on a different front. So my sense is that this has the ability to spin out in all sorts of interesting but also very dangerous ways.
There are reports that Iran has offered Russia an airbase to be used at Russia's discretion. We know that there was one bombing raid that went from Russia to Syria. Is that a permanent thing in your view, or is that a temporary alignment?
I think the way the Iranians have structured that permission, and the Iranian leaders have been very clear about, the Iranian constitution prohibits permanent basing of foreign powers on Islamic Republic soil. So the workaround that the Supreme Leader and his government have made is this sort of this, you know, case by, we're going to evaluate on a case by case basis. We're going to allow Russia to do limited operations, and we're going to be able to revoke that permission at any time. And that's actually a really interesting political card that the Iranians have to play against the Russians, because the Iranians obviously are cognizant of the fact that the Kremlin is about to receive enormous pressure from Washington about the need for Russia to hold Iran to account, the need for Russia to squeeze Iran, apply sanctions more rigidly. This is an ancillary card that the Iranians have where they can sort of go to Moscow and say in a very credible way, you know, you need to be careful what you commit to doing against us, because we hold the effectiveness of your Syria campaign in our hands in a very real sense.
Thank you. One country that has not been mentioned yet is Israel. Can you talk about Russian-Israeli relations, both as part of the Syrian civil war, because the Israelis have presented what I think they consider to be red lines, but also in the larger sense, Russian-Israeli relations in the region?
Sure. Well, let me start with the latter first, because Russia is, for Israel, a major domestic issue. Ethnic Russians, whether they're Jewish or not, make up somewhere between 20 and 25% of the overall Israeli population. And so it's not a surprise that, I mean, you can, there's many, many places in Israel where you can go where, if not the only language, then Russian is the primary language spoken. And as a result, there theoretically should be at least the way the Russians think about it, there should be access that they can get, there should be influence that they can wield over this population. That's tempered by the fact that at least the first wave or the first couple of waves of Jewish emigration out of Russia and the emigration, both Jewish and non-Jewish, that has come since, have been driven in large part by opposition to the Russian government, including in recent years, opposition to Vladimir Putin. So what you have is, at best, you have a skeptical potential electorate. And this has tended to circumscribe how resonant the Russian messaging is within Israel itself in terms of convincing Israel that Russia is a long-term ally. Nonetheless, there are certain things that the Israelis have asked for and managed to get from the Russians. Bibi Netanyahu's repeated trips to Moscow to discuss the Syrian conflict with the Kremlin could be boiled down to simply him saying, build me a moat. The idea that Israel is worried about north-south infiltration over the Golan, the Russians are in control of the airspace, in control of strategic parts of that territory. To the extent that the Kremlin can provide for the security of Israel's north, I think Vladimir Putin goes a long way towards at least temporarily aligning Russian and Israeli interests.
You had mentioned something before, though, about the possibility that Russia would be able to come into Syria only by Iran's sufferance, only by Iran's permission.
Right.
This would change the Russian-Israeli dynamic on Israel's northern border, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It most definitely would. I think that Israeli officials, you know, if you talk to Israeli officials offline, they'll tell you that, you know, the sort of the Russian control of that territory is holding for now. But obviously, if the Russians have a recalibration of their calculations about how long they're going to stay, how significant their presence in Syria is going to be, and how much they have to rely on Iran as a force augmenter, the Russians are going to have less freedom of action. They're going to be less able to build that moat that Bibi wants. And as a result, my sense is that the Israelis are watching this dynamic very closely, and they take the Russian assurances of their security, the security of Israel's north, with a grain of salt, at least for now, as they watch this evolving dynamic.
Thank you. As long as we're going around the region, can you talk about Russian-Turkish relations? Again, as regards Syria and the Kurds, but also as regards other things that Turkey and Russia find important to talk about.
Sure. And the Turkish-Russian relationship, I think, in general, is sort of one of the most interesting to watch, because the current phase of reconciliation is so completely ahistoric. The little anecdote I always like to tell is that a few years ago, I was at the Izmailovka market outside of Moscow, and they sell all these wonderful tchotchkes, and including sort of hand-carved chess sets. And I bought one that showed essentially Crusader chess pieces fighting against Muslim chess pieces. And I thought, what an interesting dynamic, what an interesting commentary on how Russia sees the Muslim world. And the vendor, as he was selling it to me, sort of leaned in close to me and whispered, "They're not just Muslims, they're Turks," right? And that was a commentary on the fact that up until this point in history, the Russians and the Turks have waged something like 13 different military conflicts, right? Russians and the Turks tend to view their respective regions, but also their overlapping interests in places like Central Asia in competitive ways. So the idea that the Russians and the Turks have built a durable alliance, frankly, is ahistoric. What you do have is you do have a Turkish government that has migrated very far away from the pledge of zero problems with neighbors that their foreign minister at the time, Ahmet Davutoğlu, articulated a few years ago, and now have really conflictual relations with virtually every country on their periphery. And as a result, particularly as Turkey begins to think of itself as more of an Islamist, more of a Middle Eastern, less of a European power, it needs external allies. And there's also all sorts of sort of energy dependencies that flow along with that that make Russia an interesting, even if temporary, an interesting partner for the Turks to engage in for the moment. But the sort of a lot of that relationship, I think, is going to be circumscribed by what ends up happening with sort of Turkey's role in NATO, and how sort of and that's in part driven by the evolving conversation that we have here about exactly how much NATO has to do in order to remain in the White House's good graces.
And just to finish that thought, the Kurds, Russia seems to have offered the Kurds some sense that they could have, I don't know, autonomy, not independence, but autonomy or some self-rule in northern Syria under the circumstance that Assad stays there. This clearly the Turks do not like. Where are they going?
Well, I don't think they know. It's an interesting conversation to watch, but it's an evolving conversation to watch. The Russians are much more sympathetic to the idea of Kurdish autonomy than the Turks, the Syrians, the Iranians all would like. However, how much Russia invests in that as a political construct is weighed against what Russia hopes to gain from its relations with Syria, its relations with Iran, its relations with Turkey, right? Which is a long way of saying that if the Turks and the Syrians yell loud, and the Iranians yell loud enough, Russian support, rhetorical support for the Kurds is going to remain just that. They can say whatever they want, but there's not really going to be any concrete moves from the Kremlin to make this a reality.
And last stop on our Middle Eastern tour, Russia and Qatar.
Well, that's actually an interesting yes, I'm sure. But the one thing I've learned in my years in Washington is that you have to be very forthright with saying what you know and what you don't know. So I am pleased to be able to say that I don't actually have any particular insight on Qatar, on sort of, you know, the Russian-Qatari relations, because to tell you otherwise, I think, would be a lie, and there's not much I can add there.
Okay. That's unusual for you, but thank you for your honesty.
It's a work in progress. What are you going to do?
There are reports that Russia's S-300 air defense system in Iran is finally operational. It's been a long time coming. Do you think that the Russians will take into account American and Israeli and other people's concerns about building
an arsenal in Iran or providing protections to Iran that could interfere with possibly necessary military action by the West against Iran? Do they only count dollars?
Right. Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Russia, the best way to think about Russia is that Russia is happiest in a particular situation when it can act as both arsonist and firefighter. So this is precisely what it did in the S-300 scenario, in which nobody asked the Russians, except the Iranians, nobody asked the Russians to offer Iran air defense equipment. But by offering it to them and then holding that contract in abeyance, they curried all sorts of good favor from the United States and from the Israeli government. What they can turn around and do now, what they've done now over the last year, has been to make good on that contract, that 2007 contract, provide these defenses to Iran and sort of hide behind the fig leaf of this is a contract, you know, we could hold it at bay no longer. By the way, the Iranians are theoretically in compliance with the international community's demands because we signed the JCPOA. There's really no contractual or practical bars to us providing this equipment. And so this is an interesting, it's sort of a telling incident, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Russians followed up this cycle with the S-300 of leveraging their potential ability to provide more sophisticated air defenses like the S-400, which is sort of a stage above the S-300 in terms of air defense capabilities, and then holding that out as a potential sort of sign of Russian good faith. You know, we haven't offered the Iranians the S-400 because we're really interested in cooperating with Israel, cooperating with the United States, and we should receive political offsets for that.
Thank you. Finishing or going back to Syria, the Russians have said that whatever happened in Syria with sarin gas was Syria bombing a factory in which the rebels held the gas and the gas leaked, and that's what killed the civilians. That is their formal position. Do you think that's their real position?
I think the real Russian position and the real Russian strategy, at least, has been to inject doubt into objective facts. Right? If you look at, and this is sort of just another sort of area where I think it's really interesting to watch, the Russians, in terms of how they deal with the Syria crisis, but also much more directly how they've dealt with their intervention in Ukraine, their information operations center around the idea that with enough media noise, they can complicate Western decision-making. So I was, before I hopped on this call, I was on a television show with a Russian talking about precisely this incident, the Syrian chemical weapons. Russian, you know, by extension, Russian culpability and all that. And the official Russian line, as translated through their interlocutor, was, how do you know this is even the Assad regime at all, right? What is the necessity to take sterner action? If we can inject doubt into the idea that the Assad regime did this, then America has an excuse for continued inaction. And I think that's the strategy they're going to be pursuing with this. Is this what they actually believe? I don't think so. I think they know very well that the chemical weapons disarmament was much more a fiction than a reality when it was imposed by the international community. I think they know that there's operational chemical weapons in Syria, and they know that Assad has both the capability and the intent to use them. Are they going to do anything about it? I think not, and I think they're going to try to stop everyone else from doing anything else either.
Thank you. Our last question, because we're coming to the close of our hour, is a more philosophical question. There has been a trend in the United States, particularly by conservatives, to interpret Vladimir Putin as the legitimate defender of Russia's national interests, meaning interests as an external power, internal controls. Does this put them in the position of supporting what essentially looks like the Tsarist Russia and agreeing that Russian expansionism, at least on that side of the globe, can be separated from Russian expansion in places that will matter to us?
So, again, a very broad question and certainly a philosophical one. I think it's necessary to highlight two things here. First of all, there tends to be a Western belief that all countries sort of come to the table with at least a common grounding of understanding of democratic principles. And that's patently not true in the case of Russia. If you go back and you read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment or whatever it is, what you understand is that throughout history, the idea of representative government, the idea of the Russian leader, whether it's a Soviet general secretary or a Russian Federation president or a czar of the Russian Empire, being beholden to its constituents is somewhat foreign to Russians. In fact, it makes them really uneasy, which is why you see this confluence of authoritarianism and popular support in Russia. Russians are really much more comfortable with a strong leader than they are with a weak leader, right? A great comparison is the levels of popularity enjoyed by Mikhail Gorbachev and by Vladimir Putin. And as a result, the Russian people as a whole are very permissive in terms of what they think the Kremlin should be allowed to do in terms of foreign policy, as long as Vladimir Putin is delivering at home. Which is why, right, for those of us that still practice that arcane art of Kremlinology, what's been really interesting to watch, in addition to the protests that have taken place throughout in Moscow and St. Petersburg and dozens of other cities over the last 2 weeks, has been to watch the governmental response to them, the sort of the riot police crackdowns, the tightening of internet controls. The Russian government is sort of in a more precarious place than most people understand, both because it's underperforming economically as a result of a whole series of self-inflicted wounds, but also because it's not clear that that compact of prosperity in exchange for limited liberties that the Russians and Vladimir Putin specifically has sort of imposed for so long is going to continue indefinitely. And that, I think, is going to color everything else. It's going to color the conception of Putin as a legitimate Russian leader, and it's going to color Russian popular support for what he's doing. For the moment, he seems to still have what the Chinese would call the mandate of heaven. But what's increasingly uncertain is how long he can maintain it. And that, I think, is the thing to watch.
I think that's a great place for us to stop, because I suspect that that is a thought that is not widely disseminated in Washington, that the lack support or lack of support for Putin could determine how long he remains the Russian leader. I think we have a tendency to think of him as eternal. So on that note, I would like to say on behalf of the Jewish Policy Center members and friends, people who are on this call and people who will listen to it on our website, thank you. This has been a most enlightening period of time for us.
Oh, my pleasure.